Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I hope you enjoy the program today. I'm going to begin with this article, Making Sense of the Pyramids' Enduring Mysteries. For 5,000 years, scholars, generals, and mystics have been fascinated by the Egyptian pyramids. That obsession persists in the modern age. By Ben McGrath. So the pyramids might have been a kind of marine industrial project, and what we now know as the sand-blasted Giza Plateau perhaps bordered a bustling harbor. It takes some getting used to. Those giant triangles in the desert, at once confounding to modern adults and relatable to preschoolers everywhere, have spawned so many crazy ideas that they long ago began to seem like primeval provocations. Some of this, including the persistent notion that these are alien deposits, was owed to the implausible sourcing and transport of so much raw material, hurdles that recede after the discovery of a lost branch of the Nile. But the pyramid's final assembly instructions remain lost in the mail. We know only that they are uncannily aligned with the cardinal directions, and that their bases are remarkably square, evidence of precision and mathematical savvy to match the apparent brawn. Or maybe no brawn was necessary. Consider the so-called sleeping prophet. About 100 years ago, a Kentucky man named Edgar Cayce began branching out from the modest fame he'd achieved as a clairvoyant, diagnosing patients while under hypnosis to the subject of the pyramids and the highly evolved souls who must have produced them. It came to him in a trance. They'd migrated from Atlantis, the ostensibly mythical island, before it sank. They chose Giza as an appropriate spot for a shrine, according to his vision, because it was at or near the center of the planet's land masses, and therefore buffered from devastating quakes and floods. It wouldn't just up and vanish like their homeland. We're talking around 10,500 BC. The pharaohs Khufu and Khafre and Menkaure, from this perspective, could be seen as merely several in a long line of latter-day opportunists claiming the cool geometry for their own designs. The stones were levitated through the use of those forces in nature as make for iron to swim in the air, Cayce intoned, while his secretary transcribed. Curiously, he also said that erecting the Great Pyramid took 100 years, far longer than the 20 or 30 estimated by classical historians and present-day Egyptologists alike. One might ask, what good is levitation if it's so much slower than manual labor? The placing of the capstone, long since missing, if it ever existed, was accompanied by a loud clanging of metal, Cayce says, to which we owe the tradition of church bells. Cayce was no longer alive when 1958 came and went. That was the year he'd said the science of levitation would be rediscovered. Supposedly there was a hall of records buried beneath the right forepaw of the Sphinx in Giza by Atlanteans who wished to document how it had all come to pass. Those secrets in the hall of records were what motivated a college dropout from North Dakota, Mark Lehner, to seek the counsel of Hugh Lynn Cayce, the prophet's son, in the early 1970s. With funding and encouragement from the Cayce Foundation, Lehner then traveled to Egypt and resumed his studies at the American University in Cairo. Thus began a decades-long career of investigation and evacuation, in which Lehner seemed to find nothing more valuable than a love of painstaking, evidence-based research. He's now one of the world's foremost Egyptologists. From fringe to fastidious in a geological blink, maybe the line was never as stark as we like to think. Lehner's effort to test the Cassian chronology in 1984 used radiocarbon dating of the interstitial organic matter between the stones, flakes of charcoal for the most part. He thought the results puzzling, but not in a way that supported the levitation hypothesis. The charcoal was a few hundred years, but not 7 or 8,000 years, older than Khufu. Might the pyramid's builders have been burning old-growth forests for their mortar? To some, this left just enough uncertainty to sustain the guessing game. If not levitation, then what? To call these things stones is understatement, on the order of Monty Python's flesh wound for amputated arms. Each weighs about as much as a minivan. Some, like the granite slabs over Khufu's chamber, are heavier than semi-trucks. But at least a van or a truck has wheels. A few decades ago, Joseph Davidovits, a chemical engineer in France, couldn't seem to fathom the manipulation of so much unyielding weight without modern technology, and proposed an oddly contemporary solution. The building blocks, in his view, were not in fact stones at all, and instead had themselves been constructed, cast in place using wooden molds and soft limestone slurry that could be schlepped upstairs in baskets. Think of them as Potemkin pyramids. You can almost conjure the squinting smiles on the ancient cement mixers' faces as they neared the apex, and imagine people in the distant future scratching heads and crediting them with an order of strength that they didn't yet know to call Herculean. Or you could, that is, until the Inspector Mirror's diary, written 4,600 years ago and discovered in 2013, documented intact stones sliding down river, basket-free. And then there are still those vaulted slabs to account for, undeniably granite, harder to fabricate. The Frenchman didn't dispute their natural origin, nor did he provide an entirely satisfactory answer to the question of why people who could lift trucks shouldn't have been expected to try lifting vans as well. The Internet made scholars of anyone with a modern and an obsession. At the same time, rapid advances in computer technology were beginning to threaten our brains with obsolescence. A new genre of pyramid specialist emerged: backyard tinkerers, pragmatists who could differentiate the fourth from the third dynasty and found comfort in the idea of a more muscular or elemental store sort of ingenuity. They tended to focus less on the industrial logistics, the quarrying, the staffing, the room and board, than on the more viscerally gratifying act of stacking. If society collapses and we're back in the Stone Ages, I'm a bee king of the heap, a retired Mississippi newspaper man told me several years ago after working up the courage to reveal a passion project that he feared could out him as a Don Quixote figure. His name was Roger Larson, and he had built, he said, a device to raise stones up the face of an Egyptian pyramid. I wouldn't necessarily have pegged myself as an ideal audience for such a boast. I was by then faintly familiar with the concept of pyramidiots, whose novel ideas included flying enormous kites to lift obelisks and making mini-rafts of inflated animal skins that could be lashed to large stones and then fed into a vast plumbing system employing locks to thwart gravity. Those sounded to me like Rube Goldberg fantasies. When contemplating the pyramids, I tended to shudder at the sheer scale of all that toil in the service of an ideal so limited that it boggled my secular egalitarian mind. Providing a nice afterlife for the pharaoh, a man lucky enough to have been born rich, the majesty was almost an affront to my middle-age inclination to idleness. In this respect, I was a little like Pliny the Elder, the great Roman naturalist and author of the first encyclopedia, who gave us one of the oldest surviving accounts of the pyramids as seen through a tourist's eyes. Publishing shortly after the reign of Nero in the 1st century A.D., Pliny criticized the transparent vainglory the Giza structures represented, the superfluous and foolish display of wealth. On the other hand, there was something appealingly democratic in the rise of an army of resourceful autodidacts against a gatekeeping archaeological establishment, and Larson, who shared snippets of dispiriting correspondence with professors he'd emailed cold, was nothing if not well-read, sprinkling references to the inspiration he'd found in Isis knots and the slotted ends of pillars on the walls at Abydos. He was convinced that earthen ramps, favored by many academics as a likely means of escorting heavy material into thin air via sledge, were a non-starter. Any ramp approaching Khufu's upper reaches that was sufficiently gentle to allow dragging heavy blocks would be more voluminous than the monument itself, and might extend a mile or more, surely leaving some archaeological trace. As with Case's purported Hall of Records, why hadn't anyone found anything? Pliny, for what it's worth, reported that he'd heard stories of salt and soda ramps, which could have been washed away by a flood, though he acknowledged that some of his contemporaries had a hard time believing this. The Lost Nile Branch wouldn't be rediscovered for nearly 2,000 years. I don't think the Egyptians could have made sandals fast enough to keep the work going, Larson said. I decided to take him up on his offer to prove the concept. The contraption was composed of logs that he'd sawed from a forest, along with lengths of knotted rope. The ancient Egyptians were known to have imported cedars from Lebanon, Larson noted. It looked like a catapult, but with oars instead of a central lever, arguably a Herodotus machine, described only vaguely by the Greek historian from his sources in the 5th century B.C., as having short pieces of timber and operating in a stepladder fashion. Larson had assembled it in a backwoods barrow pit at the top of a soft limestone embankment with a 48-degree slope, close enough, he figured, to the Great Pyramid's 52. Taking in the scene, I half expected to see Charlton Heston striding into view, hoisting the Ten Commandments. YouTube popularity is the amateur Egyptologist's Ivy League sinecure, and for the sake of what he called dramatic appeal in his video making, Larson said that he had previously tried raising a pickup. The rope snapped, and the truck went rolling to the edge of a pond. Back to the drawing board. For my demonstration, he used a large concrete block, topped with slabs of marble. Together they weighed 4,500 pounds and set on a pair of skis at the base of a poplar track that he'd affixed to the cliff face. Like any pyramid architect, Larson needed manpower. His own arms, he joked, were toothpicks, so he hired out for muscle by offering $50 and stray favors to friends and acquaintances. I should note that these people all looked sane and genially skeptical. Soon he had a proper antediluvian construction site, with a soundtrack of grunting, creaking, and laughing. The creaking came from the ropes, as several men attended to each oar, first walking it up and then pushing it back down a set of stairs flanking the main frame. The block slid up the track like a funicular in slow motion, a foot or two with each cycling of the oars. "It's a little tedious, isn't it?" Larson said, admitting that several dozen such devices and perhaps a few more sets of muscles on each oar might be needed to meet the rate of delivery required of such a massive project, if it were to be completed within a pharaoh's lifetime. So many were the stones composing the Great Pyramid that Napoleon, who'd task a legion of savants with mapping the joint, is said to have quipped that they could be repurposed to form a 10-foot wall around the perimeter of France. Almost true. As I've calculated it, the wall, perhaps fittingly, would have come up short. But the atmosphere in Mississippi grew festive over the course of a couple of hours as Larson's block neared the embankment's edge. Here stood a man who had willed into being, through the force of his own mania, a community effort so quixotic that it couldn't help stirring wonder. I thought of the graffiti on chamber walls that modern scholars have attributed to Khufu's construction gangs. Far from complaining, they seemed to be bragging. What drove Larson and his makeshift crew may not have been so different from what motivated their predecessors in antiquity, a conviction that they were engaged in something rare, and in doing so were potentially slipping the bonds of time. The block reached the lip at last. Larson proclaimed himself the first human in more than 4,000 years to achieve this, whatever it was. One down, or up rather, 2 million more to go. And now we are back at the crux of the pyramid saga, a story that is really less about technology than about patience, process, and follow-through, the stuff of which civilization is made. French Egyptologist Pierre Tallet had been sifting Egypt's dirt for more than 20 years, a sizable pharaonic term before he found the Red Sea Scrolls in 2013. You can't expect to close your eyes and visualize the secret to an essentially political project any more than you can concentrate hard enough to levitate a rock. You need to keep digging, keep reading, keep whittling, until one day the accumulation of all that effort will amount to something that our descendants can marvel at. Not long ago, Larson emailed me to say that his friend Leon, whose borrow pit he'd been using for the demonstrations, had other designs on the property. My pyramid device is still sitting on the cliff edge, rotting and drooping, he wrote. It will be pushed over the cliff and buried today, but I ask Leon to leave the 2-ton concrete block as a relic. If somebody gets interested in the demonstrations, there will be some physical proof of what was done. They can't suggest that I packed the block with styrofoam. Sure they can. What good is a mystery without a trace of conspiracy? That completes the article. Ben McGrath, the author, says he's drawn as a writer to quixotic projects and the people consumed by them. This is the first National Geographic feature for McGrath, a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of the book Riverman, An American Odyssey. The title of his article was Making Sense of the Pyramids' Enduring Mysteries. The next article is titled Inside the Elite London Neighborhood Where Shakespeare Owned a Home by Becky Little. Scholars have long known that William Shakespeare bought a home in London's Blackfriars Precinct in 1613, 3 years before his death. Now we finally know exactly where it was, about a five-minute walk from St. Paul's Cathedral. Lucy Munro, a professor of Shakespeare and early modern literature at King's College London, published an article about her discovery in the Times Literary Supplement on April 17th. Munro tells the National Geographic she was combing through the London archives when she found a floor plan of Blackfriars residences from 1668. The floor plan documented who had been living in each property when the Great Fire of London struck 2 years earlier. Using two other documents from the London Archives and the United Kingdom's National Archives, Munro was able to identify Shakespeare's home on the floor plan near the intersection of three streets, Ireland Yard, Bergen Street, and St. Andrew's Hill. Two other scholars National Geographic spoke to agree with Munro's conclusion. Her discovery provides a new peek into Shakespeare's time in London toward the end of his life, as well as insight into how women inherited and made claims to property in 17th century England. Get thee to a friary. Shakespeare's London home was part of a redeveloped 13th-century friary, essentially a monastery for friars. All the men who lived there wore black cloaks, which is how the friary became known as Black Friars. The friary had closed in the 1530s when King Henry VIII formally split from the Catholic Church so he could annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. In the process of establishing the Church of England, Henry disbanded all of the country's religious convents and seized their properties. He later sold parts of Blackfriars to courtiers and other high-status Londoners who made their homes there. Blackfriars was sold off in the 1540s to about 20 different people who bought up little chunks of the estate, says Nick Holder, a historian at English Heritage. Existing buildings were divided into separate properties, and new houses were built on the friary's former gardens and green areas. By the time Shakespeare bought a home in Blackfriars in 1613, it was still a fairly elite neighborhood, and Munro says his purchase reflected his financial and social success. Over the previous two decades, Shakespeare had split his time between London and his birthplace of Stratford-upon-Avon, where he also owned a home. In 1599, he and his acting company had built the Globe Theatre in London's Southwark district as a venue for his plays. There they staged productions of Hamlet, Macbeth, and Henry VIII. A canon mishap during a 1613 performance of Henry VIII caused the Globe to burn down, but the company rebuilt it and reopened the next year. In addition to being an elite neighborhood, Blackfriars was also a growing entertainment hub, to the dismay of its residents. In the late 16th century, Munro says locals complained about bowling alleys opening in Blackfriars. In 1596, neighbors signed a petition opposing the opening of a playhouse, arguing that it would be too noisy and draw all manner of vagrant and lewd persons. Despite the petition, the Blackfriars Theater opened, and in 1608, Shakespeare's acting company began performing there. The Blackfriars property that Shakespeare bought was just a short walk from the Blackfriars Theater, making it a convenient home for someone who staged plays there. Even so, we don't know for sure whether Shakespeare lived in his Blackfriars residence or rented it out. Scholars have assumed he retired after he wrote his last known play, The Two Noble Kinsmen, with John Fletcher around the same year he bought the property. Yet this new finding raises questions that perhaps at the time he bought his London home, he may have envisioned having a longer theater career. It wasn't to be. In 1616, Shakespeare died of unknown causes in Stratford-upon-Avon at age 52. That completes the article. The title was Inside the Elite London Neighborhood, Where Shakespeare Owned a Home, by Becky Little. And that completes the broadcast today. We have run out of time. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed today's articles. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.